Accession number 31328, reel 5.
But the effect of all this was that apart from seeing a bit of, well, quite a lot of shelling, we did almost nothing. I mean, I'll be personally in the tank towards attacking Geilenkirk. So that was that bit, and of course Christmas came after that, because this was November. And also around that time we spent some time in the town of Brunson, just before Geilenkirchen in fact, and a few of us were billeted in a very nice house for a Dutch family called the Lucases. And a girl called Christine spoke very good English, the younger daughter, and we spent about a week there and had a very good time actually, very comfortable, sleeping in it was quite a large family, but the boys, the young men, turned out of their beds so we could sleep in them. Mind you, we didn't have a bed each, we were all cramped into several beds, but that was that bit. And after that, we were coming into the winter, and things were very bad as far as sort of living conditions were. This was after not taking part in the Battle of the Bulge. But what we chiefly remember the brigadier coming round and saying, if you just expect it to be absolutely bloody, then you'll find it's all right. I couldn't quite see the logic of all that. But we were all snowed up and frozen up. And it's very difficult in any case for tanks to go on frozen roads and sit about all over the place. So I don't think we were doing very much except being shelled, as I said, during that period. The thing seemed to go into abeyance for a little while. Then what came next? I suppose the Reichswald Forest. Operation Veritable, this was, the attack into the Reichswald, which was quite exciting, a bit like Normandy in some ways. Just at that time equipped with Zoot suits, which were sort of lined waterproof suits with a hood, and what I particularly remember, they fitted up with zips, and you wore these on top of the denim suit you normally wore in the tank, and going up to the front for one attack. I particularly remember these things because I got an attack of diarrhoea, and it was the middle of the night, and there was a long troop of tanks and other things going up the line, and they moved a few yards at a time, and I had to keep getting out of the tank and going to the side of the road. But the trouble was, having got to the side of the road, I then had to get out of the zoot suit and the denim suit and pull over and do says what, and then put it all on again and hope the tank was still there when I got back on. And to make it worse, we were transporting infantry, so as well as getting to the tank in the ordinary way, I had to clamber over a lot of infantry men who were clinging to the outside in the cold, mind you, so it was a bit rotten for them as well, but that sticks in my mind as a bad night. And there were several sort of, there was a lot of shelling, because the whole thing started with a 1,000-gun barrage, and we were part of the barrage, and the tanks were all lined up in the forest, and we had to, as far as I remember, fire 300 rounds of the 75 before anything started. So it was really, really hard work. I've forgotten how often you fired them, but it was like one every 30 seconds or something. But by the time you've loaded 300 into the gun, it's a bit exhausted. And I remember an ejecting shell case, because when the 75 fired, it ejects the empty case into the floor of the tank. You have to get rid of them through the hatch. But I got one on the end of the finger, it split my finger open. So somebody had an elastoplast, fortunately, but that was somebody else had to do the last few rounds, I remember. That's about the nearest, like, apart from chipping a tooth, it's the nearest thing I got to being wounded was splitting my finger open. And another time, round about a similar time, I went out to, we were living down a cellar, as we tended to do, and the tank was outside. I went to get some tea out of the bin on the back of the tank, and a mortar bomb landed. Street, I heard it coming, and went to go down flat, but not quite quick enough, and I got the splinters in the face. I thought it was worse than that, actually, because of blood, and I thought my face was hanging off, but it wasn't really. And in fact, forever afterwards, I could see the lines where the shrapnel had gone. Well, it's more like grit than it felt as I'd been kicked in the face. But you can't see it now, it's all lost in old age, wrinkles and things. But as I say, I think that's the nearest I came to being wounded, other than being deafened.
How much ammunition did the tanks carry?
That's a good one, isn't it? I can't remember that.
Was it enough to fire those 300 rounds without needing to?
No, it didn't carry that many rounds. The rounds were delivered up in cardboard container, well, cardboard, I suppose, long black tubes, and the end pulled off and the rounds stood out. And they were all piled up by the side of the tank, and they were handed in as fast as they were going. I think they carried more like 50 or 60. If I'm talking nonsense, nothing like 300, but that's that sort of figure, probably, because they're stacked in sponsons, as I say, at the side of the turret and round the bottom of the turret floor. It can't have been, it's as many as you're ever likely to need in normal circumstances, but not for a thing like this. What I do remember, the idea was that you fired for 2 hours or whatever, and then a 5 minutes break to see if everything was firing back. And the moment we stopped firing, a German Spandau fired back from the distance. I thought, well, all that effort, there's still somebody sitting there. I also remember the night before, because people were sleeping down in the wood near, in actual German dugouts. There's an old German dugouts there, and there was a wooden plank over the top to hide light inside, and I was on guard, and of course you couldn't show any light, it was pitch dark, and I was supposed to wake the next guard, and I knew who he was, but I couldn't find the dugout he was in, and I had a torch, and I thought, well, I have to shine the torch, and I did, and the moment I switched it on, somebody took a shot, a sniper's shot, came wanging over, you know, and I put up pretty quickly and went down flat, and I thought that was, and also they had at that point, during the day, we were living in a house before the barrage, and they're obviously firing machine guns into the air, because as you walk up to the house, you've got suddenly a line of bullets came along the side of the path, out of nowhere, you know. It's a bit unnerving. They'd obviously at a long range. Another funny thing like that, and I can't place exactly when it ran, a bit later than this, there was obviously a self-propelled gun firing armour-piercing shots at long range, because these turned up from nowhere, and I even saw one bounce across a field like a stone on water, you know. And getting up one morning, one came right through the house. We were shaving, and it hit one side and went out the other. That was an alarming experience as well. Because it's not a very big house, you know, there's showers of plaster, and one chap was actually shaving, and it just missed his head as it had showered him in plaster. But these are sort of minor activities that went on. I'm sorry I can't connect all these up to other things. It's a rambling story. And it must have been somewhere there where when we were rejoining the squadron, we must have been away for some point. We got there and the place had been incredibly stonked, as we used to say, shelled, and we got a new officer temporarily on, Mr. Thornley, and we were put out at the end of a garden which overlooked miles of countryside to see if anything was coming, and we saw something move into a wood in the distance, and what it was actually was a label there for the Moaning Minnies, and a shot came over, which burst overhead, and obviously a ranging shot, and then they started putting over these Moaning Minnies, and I particularly remember because they were bursting all round us, and I looked over and saw Mr. Thornley, the officer, was standing with his head out looking round vaguely, you see, and I said, it might be a good idea to come in and shut the lid. And he said, do you think it's advisable? I can remember saying that, and I mean, it certainly was, because these are sort of things that we'd had experience of something coming actually into the tank before. Anyway, that's another, I mean, it's one of these times when nothing particular was going on, but nevertheless it was quite exciting.
What sort of condition was the countryside and the towns in as you were moving eastwards through Belgium?
You mean up round in Belgium, but in the Reichsveld there's been a sort of damage to the towns. I mean, it wasn't like Normandy where the place really was a wreck, but there were a lot of wrecked houses about, and also of course it was under snow a lot of the time, and then underwater on the island, because the place was, they'd broken the flood defences and the ground was flooded, so it wasn't very nice. But of course other times we were going through towns that were more or less all right, because nobody had shelled them beforehand or anything like that. We arrived out of the blue all the way up on the breakthrough through Lille and Beauvais. They weren't damaged at all. But we spent a lot of time in cellars eating eggs, I remember, because we used to find hen houses and pinch the eggs. You know. And also, we had a sort of tin fruit. This wasn't very good on the digestion, really, because we were living off the land to a large extent at that point. And we got rations, but people would rather have real eggs and real tin fruit than the stuff they sent up.
How much contact were you having with civilians?
Not a lot, I don't think, at all, really, but except to say, can I use your cellar? But we must have had a bit more, because I distinctly remember one or two places where we actually moved into a house and sat down with them and had a supper, you know. Don't ask me for details of that. Around this time, well, things were relatively quiet, as I say. I suppose there was time to establish a bit of contact. But it wasn't close contact. Whether there were things going on that I didn't even know about, I don't know. But I mean, I wasn't aware of a lot of contact.
Had you had any leave since arriving?
Yes. Well, two things. They started Brussels leave, and I was the first person to go on Brussels leave from our regiment, and that was almost, well, within two or three weeks after the incident when we had the shell in the tank, and Bill Dawson and I and some other people went to Brussels, and they put us up in a very nice hotel. The only trouble was I hadn't got much money, I remember that. But there were various free activities going on, like a London theatre company, a lady from Edinburgh, with Sophie Stewart, I remember that, and cinemas were free. So you could have a reasonable time. We were there about 3 days. And of course we had a proper room in the hotel with a, I was going to say with a bath, but I actually had a shower. The NCOs and officers had baths. I mean, all suite baths. But that was all right. And in fact, I went twice on Brussels leave before the end of the war. Each time 3 days. But the next time, we were sent to a kind of, it was actually a monastery just outside Brussels, and it had been taken over as a kind of hostel for troops, so they weren't any longer having the hotels, not as far as I was concerned anyway. And I went with a couple of chaps, and we decided we wouldn't stay in this hostel, we'd find a hotel for ourselves. And we went to one which was called the Golden Lion, but I realise now it wasn't all it seemed to be. It was a sort of house of ill repute, as they say. But we were too innocent to realise this when we booked in, but we could see what was going on, because I remember a chap, an infantry chap, staggering out of a room walking down the corridor, and he said, "What kind of place is this?" And I hadn't realised it was any particular kind of place. Nevertheless, we had quite a nice 3 days then as well. Then I got home leave. That must have been in January. And came home for a week. And it proved to be a bit longer than a week because the weather was bad, and they couldn't. But they couldn't take us on the day they intended. But I was already in Dover by then, so it wasn't very helpful. But that was the only time I came home, actually during the war. But and the thing that struck me more than anything else, you went through big transit camps to get to the boat, and hardly any of the people there were infantry or tanks, because obviously you had to be there a certain length of time to qualify for leave, and far less people in infantry and tanks had lasted long enough to qualify at all. So most of the people there were people from support units, like, you know, what do you call it, REMI and RASC and Pioneers and that sort of thing. But yeah.
Had you been able to have any contact with your family before returning home, throughout the campaign?
There'd been contact and only letters, and the post was, as far as I remember, pretty good throughout, in both ways. So we were always in touch. It was censored mail. In an emergency, you had a little card, but you simply struck off a thing that didn't apply, you know, like it said, "I'm well, I'm injured, I'm dead," or whatever, and you crossed off the appropriate ones. But I think only a couple of times sent those. And then they had what they called green envelopes, which were censored at base, but not by your own officers, because normally if you wrote an ordinary letter, it was censored by people who actually knew, and I didn't like that much. But these green envelopes, which are in short supply, it went away from the regiment, and someone you've never heard of censored it. So that was a better idea. I've still got one stuck in that book up there.
Was there any sort of official instruction as to how the troops were to behave towards the civilian population in France and Belgium and Netherlands?
Yes, there was. And particularly, well, I mean, it might just act decently to them, really, but the particular instructions, more or less in the words of Montgomery, how to behave in Brussels while I leave. And I've got the instructions there, actually, now. But there, see, yeah, but it said all Brussels are out of bounds. But I think it was just rubbing in the sort of things you might expect. You know, you've got to be nice to them all.
But for the behaviour in Brussels, how rigidly was that enforced?
Not very, I should have thought. No, I don't think it was. I mean, not my own experience, but hearing people describing their adventures in Brussels, I would have thought nothing was particularly enforced. I don't know how they could have enforced it, really. You know, you'd need a lot of people patrol to see what everyone was doing. What I remember about Brussels, particularly, is how much better off they seem to be than we were in England, because although they'd been under German rule, the big shops there were full of sort of fancy goods and ice cream and that kind of thing, which I'd never seen for years. I don't know how this worked out quite.
What next after you returned from leave?
This is where it's difficult, isn't it? Can we pause a second? Because I knew I'd run into trouble when it got to the sort of winter period. And, in the Reichswald Forest. We succeeded in holding up the entire Second Army, I mean our tank did, because we're going up through very close wood. Sorry, my earpiece is weird. The ground gave way under one of the tank tracks. It was snowing, and we went over sideways and blocked the only way up. And so everything coming, and the whole trail of tanks, friend carriers, guns coming up behind us, and we were totally stuck. And not only that, we couldn't get anything up to us that could pull us out. And we were there for hours, and because all the tanks in front had gone on ahead, although we'd said we'd bogged down, the squadron needs to follow us up as quickly as you can without thinking that we were blocking everybody else. And hours later, they managed to get away round us for a 17-pounder tank to come and pull us out backwards up the cable. And actually, our driver revved up and backed into the 17-pounder gun, pushing it right back into the turret and destroying the mounting. But nevertheless, it got us out of the way, and everything, including ourselves, was able to go on up the road. And it's what's stuck in my mind. I remember a flying bomb going over at the time, V1, going over low, because they were sort of cruising around over Holland at the time. But anyway, I mean, the next item after I came back on leave was getting towards the Rhine, and we were all set for the Rhine crossing, of course. And we were towed over on a raft. They had a balloon winch on the far side, which pulled the raft over with the tank on it. And we didn't do the actual assault crossing. The infantry got across first, and some other tank regiment, and we went over during the night. And I remember, in fact, they tried, it was going a bit slowly, they tried putting two tanks on one raft, and the raft sank, tanks and all, in the middle of the Rhine, which wasn't helpful. And when we were going across, a German plane came over terribly low, and it was difficult to know. We were right out in the middle of the Rhine, which seems like a sea when you're on it. I couldn't think whether it's best to stay inside, because the German plane was machine gunning, to stay inside or to sit up on top in case the thing sank, you see. But I sort of crouched half in and half out. But we got there, in fact. We came over. The plane was so low, it was hitting the actual opposite bank, you know, as it went towards it. So that, in the end, put us on the other side of the Rhine. And we were then detailed. The tank at the time, because one had been destroyed, of course, when the shell... well, not destroyed, but put out of action. And the next tank, we actually named Shaggy Dog. And the reason for this was because I was very keen at the time on Shaggy Dog stories. Do you know about Shaggy Dog stories? And I was well known for, if anything, for telling interminable Shaggy Dog stories, you see. And so we named the tank Shaggy Dog, although people thought it was unlucky to name a tank at all. But we got Ted Payne, our stained glass artist, to paint Shaggy Dog on the side of the tank. Anyway, we found we were detailed to lead the advance on the other side of the Rhine. And this is another thing we didn't feel too cheerful about, because it was up a road, and there were, what the advance consisted of was the squadron of tanks interspersed with Kangaroo personnel carriers, which were like Sherman, again, Shermans without a turret. Each would carry about a dozen infantrymen. And in fact, I didn't realise at the time, but the Kangaroos came from the 1st Canadian Personnel Carrier Regiment, but the infantry weren't Canadian. But anyway, the thing was one road wide, obviously the advance, and we thought we'd had a bit of luck, because they said the advance will actually be led by two light reconnaissance tanks, which are called Hunnies, belonging to our HQ squadron. So we thought that puts us back a bit. And anyway, we set off the next morning, and these two Hunnies were in front of us, and we were the first tank of the actual squadron. And they went off out of our sight, and we got a report of a tank in the neighbourhood from air reconnaissance, and they gave a map reference, and you were only allowed to give a real map reference if you, it was obvious to the enemy that it referred to them and they knew where they were anyway, if you see what I mean. But it was a real map reference, and they said there's a tiger handy, and when I looked on the map I saw it was only the next field. So this made it a bit worrying as well, but we plugged on, and we came to a village called Sinderen. We're in Holland, by the way, at this point. And then we discovered that there was smoke drifting across the road. And I remember saying to the commander at that time, don't look now, but I think something's on fire up there. And when we went round the corner, the second Honey was in the ditch, and the commander was lying dead on the turret.